It's Tuesday, October 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Russia's president orders suspension of plutonium cleanup program with the United States. The U.S. suspends talks with Russia on Syria.
The agreement isn't perfect. It's better than any potential alternative. And I think the country is really unprepared for this.
Some voters say no to a peace deal. Also ahead, uncertain financial markets, and a new TV series pits fantasy versus reality. It's all on today's International Edition. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed a decree suspending an agreement with the United States on disposing of weapons-grade plutonium. The decree states the move was taken due to what Moscow calls, quote, a drastic change in circumstances, the emergence of a threat to strategic stability as a result of unfriendly actions by the United States of America with respect to the Russian Federation. VOA's Daniel Sheriff in Moscow has more on details in this conversation with International Edition host Sarah Williams.
According to the Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, they're talking about political, military, and economic imbalances in the world. So there was a big laundry list of requirements that Russia has in order to restore this plutonium accord between the two sides. Essentially, this is just a real indication of how bad relations are now between Russia and the United States over the situation in Syria. And, of course, we have the backdrop of the situation in Ukraine as well.
The invasion of Crimea.
Yeah, the annexation of Crimea, Russia's involvement in eastern Ukraine, supporting the rebels there with troops and military equipment. All of that, of course, has been boiling in the backdrop. But the real problem, of course, that we've seen is the falling apart of the agreement that we thought was reached between Russia and the United States over the situation in Syria and trying to get humanitarian aid into Aleppo. Now we have Russia backing the Syrian offensive on Aleppo that's created all kinds of tensions between the two sides. Very little discussion happening now between Washington and Moscow on trying to re-implement any kind of a peace agreement on Syria at the moment.
Russia also has claimed that the U.S. is unable to ensure the implementation of its obligations to utilize surplus weapons-grade plutonium. What does Moscow mean by that?
Well, basically, this agreement that was made back in 2000 when Bill Clinton was president of the United States was to try and reduce the amount of plutonium that the two sides had that could be used for creating nuclear weapons. And the idea was to take that plutonium and turn it into a fuel for nuclear power plants. So it would be used for producing peaceful nuclear energy rather than the kind that could be used for war. So the agreement was made, and unfortunately, it's run into problems since then. Essentially, it appears that the Russians are using the breakdown in relations right now over Syria as more or less an excuse to scrap this agreement, to send a signal of dissatisfaction to the U.S.
Daniel, I understand that Russian President Putin made some demands regarding the U.S. What were some of those demands?
Yeah, he made a striking list of demands, actually, including canceling all sanctions against Russia, scaling back NATO troops, troop levels around Europe to the level when the deal was made in 2000. You know, there were very, very serious demands, also compensating Russia for some of the economic loss from economic sanctions, including its own counter sanctions, which was interesting. So, basically a laundry list saying this is you're going to have to, you know, scale back troops. You're going to have to cancel all your sanctions against us and give us a lot of money. Essentially, it's just sending a very strong signal that Russia is not pleased with the United States and wants the U.S. to make serious moves to try and please Moscow while all this tension is occurring between Washington and Moscow over the situation in Syria.
VOA's Daniel Sharif in Moscow. In a bill submitted Monday to the State Duma, the lower house of Russia's parliament, Russian President Vladimir Putin asked the country's legislators to support the suspension of the plutonium deal. It's time now for us to check out what's trending online, and we do that with our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee. She's right here in the studio next to me with curated tweets, hashtags, and much more. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. Let's start with an interesting turn of events from two media outlets. Cable TV station CNN is going to have a team of new employees, and that's because it hired the entire investigative political research department from online publication BuzzFeed. The team is called K-File, and it's led by longtime BuzzFeed reporter Andrew Kaczynski. So you know that name comes from Kaczynski. Mm-hmm. Naturally, he tweeted about it. He's on Twitter at K-File and retweeted a breaking news about the change from a media reporter and captioned it, "Some personal news." He also tweeted, "Going to miss my BuzzFeed family and so grateful for the mentorship and opportunity given to me by BuzzFeed Ben and at Catherine Miller. The first is the company's editor-in-chief and the second is its political editor."
Pretty big news. What are people saying about this change online?
So some people are saying, can you imagine BuzzFeed Andrew, that's Kaczynski's old handle, fact-checking Trump's former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, live on CNN while seated right next to him in the studio. And many media insiders are tweeting that it's a huge loss for BuzzFeed and a huge get for CNN.
Or as Trump might say, ooge. Well, I also noticed that American celebrity Kim Kardashian was trending on social media today. What happened to her?
Oh, big time. Yeah. More than 390,000 people were talking about her on Facebook alone. She was reportedly held up at a gunpoint in a hotel in Paris, and French police have confirmed that she was tied up and that several millions worth of jewelry was taken. And it looks like she's unharmed and is now no longer in Paris. Most of the reactions on Twitter are jokes about her, which comedian James Corden pointed out in his tweet. He wrote, "People making jokes about Kim Kardashian tonight would do well to remember that she is a mother, a daughter, a wife, and a friend. Be nice or be quiet." That's all for me today, Jim.
Well, that's a rather nice observation, actually. Thanks for the wrap-up, G. And you may follow us on Twitter on our own stream for International Edition at VOA underscore IE. We also have our individual accounts. I'm at VOA Stevenson, and G is at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia: Taliban overruns territory in new Afghan offensives. India adopts more assertive posture with Pakistan. New fighting and displacement show limits of Myanmar peace process. Philippines eyeing aid windfall from diplomacy shift. Vietnam investment plunges in Cambodia, sparking concerns. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more at the voanews.com website, and also on our VOA mobile app if you happen to have a smartphone. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. In a surprise result, Colombians narrowly voted on Sunday to reject a peace agreement ending the Western Hemisphere's longest-running conflict. The deal was painstakingly negotiated over 4 years, and it was between the government and the Revolutionary Forces of Colombia, or FARC, and was widely expected to receive resounding public support. But just over 50% of voters said no. Peter Hakim, President Emeritus and Senior Fellow at the Inter-American Dialogue in Washington, tells VOA's Victor Beatty that former Colombian President Álvaro Uribe was a leading opponent of this agreement.
If you look at where the votes, clearly the yes to the peace treaty won in most of the larger cities, many of the coastal areas. It was in the mountainous central part of Colombia that it lost. My sense was that he managed to really drum up votes in where he was a powerful, popular political figure.
Well, he was opposed to the treaty, and why?
Right. Why? He felt that it was inadequate, that the FARC, many of them were criminals. They had committed heinous acts against civilians. And he also strongly opposed the notion that the FARC should be allowed to participate in Colombia politics. He viewed them as really outlaws, criminals, and he just never felt comfortable with the idea of giving parity to the two sides, the government and the guerrillas. He long thought that the government should have done more to impose its will and impose justice on the FARC.
The rebel leader has still expressed his group's willingness to work toward peace after the defeat of the referendum. Does that suggest that fighting will not necessarily resume automatically?
It's just very hard to make any predictions. I've never seen or heard of a plan B. What happens if the country loses? They can't vote against this. It took 4 years to accomplish. Who doesn't want peace? If the agreement isn't perfect, it's better than any potential alternative. And I think the country is really unprepared for this. But I think a portion of the Colombian political elite that participated in the Santos government and in the negotiations and supported this really suffered a terrible loss. I think that it's going to be a very hard set of issues to work through now. What happens next? Some people on both sides that want to sort of continue the negotiations, but there's going to be people on the extremes of both. This is the opportunity to really do in the FARC once and for all.
Leaders on both sides have indicated that they will try to revive the peace plan rather than return to a conflict that began in 1964 and killed a 250,000 people. Russian-backed Syrian government forces are pressing their week-old assault on the rebel sector of Aleppo following the collapse of last month's ceasefire. Syrian troops, bolstered by Shiite militia and Russian air power, press their offensive from north to south, with international outrage growing over the shelling and airstrikes targeting hospitals and the city's water supplies. University of Pennsylvania regional analyst Ian Lustig says the Russians are once again taking a calculated risk with global public opinion.
This is a recapitulation of what Russia did in Chechnya. I think they think they can somehow get away with it. I think they're confident that there won't be a military intervention to stop them and that they can win a victory, that is to say, completely eradicate rebel presence and supporting population presence and take Aleppo, and they won't suffer political consequences that would bother them very much. I don't think that they can sustain this for a long time, but possibly long enough. I think the world is mobilizing its voice, but very little else. The only thing I think that would stop this, other than their decision that it cost them too much and bad publicity, is anti-aircraft weapons in the hands of the rebels. It would seem that, as many observers have said, that this conflict is headed for a partition of Syria. And it seems that the Russians have decided that Aleppo is going to be, or what was left of Aleppo, is either going to be within the Assad state zone, or it's going to be so destroyed as to be worthless to those who do rule that area afterward. But that's what it seems to me, is they are trying to carve Aleppo into the zone. They intend to split the country up.
Ian Lustig adds, while Russia would win a tactical victory in that scenario, he hopes there will soon be war crimes investigations of both the Syrian and Russian leadership. VOA financial correspondent Jill Malandrino is now joining us on International Edition from New York to smooth out our view of financial markets that are in flux as we now head into the final quarter of the trading year.
This is really interesting because the major averages posted strong quarterly results on Friday as the Nasdaq Composite led the way in Q3, gaining a full almost 10%, while the S&P added just about 3% and the Dow just about 2%. That was the strongest quarterly gain since the fourth quarter of 2015. But you have to remember, if you take a look at a quarterly chart from the beginning of July to the end of September, where we really got that momentum was right after Brexit around June 27th. We had that two-day sell-off, and then we just skyrocketed from there. For about 2 weeks, the middle of July, we essentially flatlined. So if you took out that performance from Brexit to the middle of July, we probably would have been essentially flat to about 1% to 2% down.
there seemed to be a little sigh of relief, at least on the Deutsche Bank front, as the fines Deutsche Bank is potentially facing seem to be less now.
Well, that's another interesting story where at first blush, when you get the headline number, it looks like it's positive. Now, if you dig deeper and look at German law, for an amount that large where they would have settled for about $4 to $5 billion versus the $14 billion headline number, they have to file a report with German securities authorities letting them know that this amount will be impacting the balance sheet. They never filed that report with the authorities within those 24 hours. So right now, it's really just conjecture according to sources with the French press agency. They still have not settled this in terms of legalities.
Looking ahead, we have the fourth quarter, and this could be an historic quarter.
Oh, absolutely. So within less than 5 weeks, we're going to have a new commander-in-chief, and that is certainly going to rock the markets to a certain extent. I would expect that the technology sectors will continue to do well, especially in the areas of semiconductors and cybersecurity. Cybersecurity is on the forefront of everyone's mind in today's day and age. That is one thing we'll be focusing on. Of course, interest rates. If we don't get the hike in the November FOMC meeting, we'll start to look to December. So those are two big variables within the market.
Well, if we had an information sector, Jill Malandrino's stock would be at record highs. Jill, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You can be sure to follow all the latest financial news and everything else on our website at voanews.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE and check out our Facebook page. It's VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The U.S. presidential election takes place on November 8th, 2016. VOA provides extensive coverage of this important political event. Who are the candidates, and what are the issues that will determine who the next president will be? Tune in around the clock for coverage of the U.S. presidential election, right here on VOA.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. A new series from HBO titled Westworld revisits the late Michael Crichton's 1973 film and asks viewers, if they could live in a fantasy without consequences, what would they do? International Edition's David Byrd tells us about the new series, which stars Oscar winner Anthony Hopkins, Ed Harris, Thandie Newton, and others, in a Wild West theme park where it's hard to tell the robots from the humans.
Do you know where you are?
I'm in a dream.
You're in my dream. I designed every part of this place. It's not a theme park, but an entire world.
In HBO's new series, Westworld, Anthony Hopkins stars as Dr. Robert Ford, who has created the theme park to help guests live out their Wild West fantasies. Westworld bills itself as totally immersive with no consequences and is peopled by so-called hosts, highly sophisticated artificial intelligence robots who believe themselves to actually be gunfighters, ranchers, cattlemen, and prostitutes. Something starts to go wrong, though, when the hosts diverge from their pre-scripted behavior and remember some of who they are. It seems Dr. Ford has slipped some code into their programming to make them more lifelike, but it might have given them free will. James Marsden plays Teddy Flood, a guest at Westworld.
And there's no consequences. There's no laws. So you can do whatever you want. So it shows what is revealed about the humans and our desires, and also examining like artificial intelligence and when does life begin and when does it end and when does consciousness begin, when does that end. And so these are the themes that, not to get too heady or pretentious, but these are, you know, sort of the underlying themes of the show. And then, you watch it all play out.
Thandie Newton plays Maeve Millay, the local madam. She says the series uses fantasy and the Western theme park to explore issues that are very relevant in our world.
you know, Westworld is a place to go and treat robots that think they're humans like pieces of rancid meat. You know, it's arguable that that happens in the world with sex tourism, sex trafficking. I mean, we have to be frank with ourselves, and it's impossible to do that, it seems. But what we can do are create stories that are really well researched, that have their root in probability about the future that isn't fantasy. And through that, we can perhaps rehearse where we would like to find ourselves, you know, in seven generations. So the invitation's open.
Eben Rachel Wood plays Dolores, a rancher's daughter who is involved with Teddy. She says that viewers can look for shocks and surprises. Even the cast didn't know what was going to happen from one episode to the next.
Some incredible characters. I think at the beginning, you know, you really get to know them, you get to know the park, and then it's going to take a plummet into a roller coaster that I don't think anybody's ever really prepared for. I mean, we're on the show and we found out what was going to happen script by script. We didn't know in advance anything. And we were shocked and floored, especially episode 10. So just get ready. It's coming.
Westworld also stars Ed Harris in his first major television role as a sadistic repeat guest dressed in all black who seems bent on uncovering what is happening to the hosts. Westworld is written by Oscar nominee Jonathan Nolan, known for the Dark Knight movies and the television show Person of Interest, and his wife Lisa Joy, who's known for Burn Notice and Pushing Daisies. Emmy winner J.J. Abrams is the executive producer. Westworld is available on HBO. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website, voanews.com. We're also on Facebook at VOA Now, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Jim Harmon. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thank you so much for spending part of your day with us. Have a great day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Iran's human rights record, as the U.S. State Department's most recent worldwide report noted, remains dismal, despite rhetorical changes from government officials who pledged to restore and expand freedoms for the Iranian people. Among the violations the State Department cited were severe restrictions on civil liberties, including freedom of the press and expression, executions without due process, and politically motivated violence and repression. In September, human rights monitors called attention to new incidents that are raising concern. On September 19th, Sadra Mohaghegh, social affairs editor of the reformist Shag newspaper, was reportedly arrested by security agents. His computer and phone were confiscated, supposedly on the grounds that he had a relationship with counter-revolutionary media. On September 17th, another journalist, Yoshar Soltani, remained detained in Naveen prison after he was not able to post bail for his release. According to the International Campaign for Human Rights in Iran, Mr. Soltani was arrested after complaints were brought against three news stories he published. Meanwhile, prominent reformist journalist Esau Sahargiz also remains in prison, though his sentence for the purported crime of insulting the supreme leader was recently reduced from 3 years to 21 months. Mr. Sahargiz was part of the wave of journalist arrests that took place in November 2015 and included newspaper editor Ehsan Morzandarani as well as newspaper columnist Ofarin Chitsoz. Whether journalists are advocating for national political reform or reporting on a local land deal, they are not safe from Iranian prisons, said the Committee to Protect Journalists Middle East and North Africa program coordinator Sharif Mansour. We call on Iranian authorities to stop arbitrarily throwing journalists in jail and let the press do its job. President Barack Obama has said that all nations, including Iran, are stronger and more successful when they uphold human rights.
A free press that can expose abuse and injustice makes a country stronger. An independent judiciary that upholds the rule of law. And free and fair elections so that citizens can choose their own leaders. These are all the rights that we seek for all people.
President Obama said the reason the United States speaks out for these rights is not because we think our own country is perfect, no nation is, but because we believe human rights are the birthright of every human being.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.